Thank you so much for that refreshing music. And there have been a lot of things about our visit here this time that have been refreshing. A lot of features about this place that are therapeutic, including that music. And incidentally, before I forget, I would like to invite all of you to help us out with a photo after the service. Maybe we could get a picture of everybody together. That'd be kind of nice if we could do that. We'd appreciate that. So maybe Laura will organize that right after the service here as we make sure that we catch you all for that. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, if you would turn there, we have a scripture that I'd like to begin with this morning. Deuteronomy chapter 4, starting at verse 5. Deuteronomy 4, starting at verse 5. Deuteronomy chapter 4, we'll start at verse 5. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that ye should do so in the land whither ye go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely, this great nation is a wise and understanding people. God's design is that we would arrest the attention of the world, and that in looking at us, they would say, these people have something better. That's what we just read. It's actually his plan for the world to notice us and desire to have what we have. In the book Education on page 296, it puts it this way: something better is the watchword of education, the law of all true living. Whatever Christ asks us to renounce, he offers in its stead something better. I'd like to ask you to ponder this question for a moment this morning. When people come here, do they see something better? Is that what strikes them? Something better. It's supposed to. When people meet us and they spend time with us, they see where we live, the way we live, what we do. What I'm reading in Scripture is the response by those in the world is supposed to be, these people have something better. They must have a great and wise God to give them such rules that they live this kind of better life. And it's desirable to them. There are many ways that this is played out, or should be played out, in the life of Christ's followers. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, if you just turn over a couple pages, Deuteronomy 7, starting at verse 12, it says this: it shall come to pass, verse 12, chapter 7, it shall come to pass, if ye hearken to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord thy God shall keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he sware unto thy fathers, and he will love thee and bless thee and multiply thee. He will also bless the fruit of thy womb and the fruit of thy land, thy corn and thy wine and thine oil, the increase of thy kind, the flocks of thy sheep in the land which he sware unto thy fathers to give thee. Thou shalt be blessed above all people. There shall not be male or female barren among you or among your cattle, and the Lord will take away from thee all sickness and will put none of the evil diseases of Egypt which thou knowest upon thee, but will lay them upon all them that hate thee. There it is again. Something better. Is this reality for us? I was reading not long ago in Testimonies, Volume 6, page 223, where it says this: the Lord years ago gave me special light in regard to the establishment of a health institution where the sick could be treated on altogether different lines from those followed in any other institution in the world. Something better. Incidentally, this statement also from Testimonies to Ministers, page 416, the indifference which has existed among our ministers in regard to health reform and medical missionary work is surprising. Some who do not profess to be Christians treat these matters with greater reverence than do some of our own people, and unless we arouse, they will go in advance of us. Incidentally, In Testimonies for the Church, Volume 6, Mrs. White said that that had come true, that others were already going in advance of us because we didn't embrace the something better plan that God gave to us with regard to healthful living. We could look at a number of aspects that I believe God has blessed us with something better. An understanding of prophecy, an understanding of end-time events and where we are in the stream of things and what's coming. And if there's ever been a time that people are ready to hear the prophetic understanding that we have to give to them, it's right now. Many, many millions of Americans see what's been happening in recent years. They see the loss of liberty, the crumbling of the Constitution in our country, and they would like to make sense of all this, and we can help them. There are many who are raising the alarm about what's happening. There are organizations coming together. You've heard of the Tea Party and the like. Many people identifying the problem, but people need to understand the spiritual significance. They need to understand what this means to them and what's coming next and where this is going to go and what's the real solution. God has blessed us with something better to help people at this very time, even in the political environment that we're living in. I believe that God has blessed us with an understanding of something better for a bad economy. You know, we're told that if we would apply ourselves to learn agriculture, that the earth would bring forth its riches. That's what we're told in Inspiration. And I believe that's not just symbolism in talk, that God has given us a plan to deal with even the economic turbulence around us in very practical ways. God has given us an edge in understanding the gospel. And I'm so thankful for the truth that whatever your past may be, you can bring that to Jesus today. Isn't that great? No matter what it is, you can come to Him. He says, "Whoever comes to me, I will in no wise cast out." And there are people that are literally carrying around a burden of guilt year after year after year, and it's destroying them. Maybe it's destroying you. You can be free of that guilt today. There is something better. And by the way, I believe that we've been given something better, even an edge in the gospel, that yes, forgiveness and cleansing is wonderful and it's good news, but you know, for some people, that's all they've got. And it sounds ironic to even say that because that's a lot. But God wants you to be a conqueror. He doesn't want you to have to be going back again and again with the same failures. He wants you to be an overcomer. In fact, it is the overcomers who are going to make it through, and Jesus is ready and willing to make you an overcomer. That's something better. We've been given something better in an understanding even of time. And right now we're standing here, sitting here today in holy time. This is an amazing concept. Do you think about this when you're driving to church on Sabbath sometimes? You look at the car next to you that you pass, you know, wherever they're going, but you wonder, and maybe they look at you, you're kind of dressed up, and they wonder, where are you going on Saturday morning? But sometimes I think about this when I'm driving, that this is holy time. People don't know this. It's an amazing thing about God's power that He could take a period of time and bless it, and that time is holy. There is something inherent in this time period that you can touch, that you can be blessed by if you will remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. That's amazing. Something better in education. I'm really excited about the School of the Prophets that Pastor Thompson is pursuing here, because God's given us a plan for something better in education, and clearly that is what the School of the Prophets is about. But what I want to move to now is what happens when we come together on Sabbath morning, because God has given us something better there too. In our time during Sabbath school, we were talking about our role in the church, the role of ministers, the role of church members, and asking ourselves the question, you know, what is God's instruction for us? And we're learning that it's something better. By the way, if you were a little uncomfortable with what we were talking about during Sabbath school, that's good, because I'm starting to learn something that it's only as I become more comfortable with being uncomfortable that I can start to experience growth. You know, the growth doesn't happen when you're just in a state of comfort. You have to push the edges to grow and to improve and to get better at anything, no matter what it is. And so I want to talk about moving us more into a role of ministers that God has called us to be. And there is a very distinctive difference in the kind of worship experience that God has called us to that will, if we will embrace it, it will move us out of a spectator role, out of the passenger seat, and put us into the cockpit. And it's a very exciting place to be. So we're going to talk about worship. The focus of the battle at the end, you understand, comes right down to worship. This is where everything converges at the end. So it's an important subject. It's an important subject in terms of the times we're living in. If you look at Revelation chapter 13, you can see this focus of worship. Revelation 13, verse 15, where it says, "He had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not," what's the word? "Worship the image of the beast should be killed." Make no mistake about it, worship becomes focal, the focal point at the end. And I want to suggest to you that it's not only about the day, which day, but that God has a plan for how his people are to carry out worship. Worship, ironically, has become very controversial in Adventism. And I shouldn't say just in Adventism. It's very controversial in the Christian world. We're not the only ones to have battles over worship and how it should be carried out and what kind of music is appropriate in worship. Music has been one of the greatest controversies in many denominations, not just Adventism. And so all kinds of labels have been created in recent years. And I think about some years back when the controversy really sort of took on a bit of a steeper slope, you might say. And we had celebration service. Remember that? When some of you, and that was the buzzword. And an interesting thing has happened over the years because the language has been changing. And there's new words that have come along, and pretty soon there was the word culturally relevant, which became a new buzzword for worship. But I want to suggest to you that in this battle and controversy over worship, that if you haven't seen it yet in Adventism, just stick around long enough and you will, but there is something happening that there's a name for it. It's a strange name, but it's called a Morton's Fork. Have you heard of a Morton's Fork? Anybody? Let me tell you why it's called a Morton's Fork. It's named after John Morton, who was Lord Chancellor of England in 1487. It was his responsibility to raise money through taxation. And so Lord Morton devised a philosophy that went like this. If you are rich, then apparently you need to pay more taxes because you have too much money. And if you are poor, you must be hiding your money, and so we need to charge you more taxes too. And that's called a Morton's Fork. It's a no-win. It was just two mutually exclusive options, which were both bad. There's a term in logic. People who get involved in debate and argumentation, they have another term for this. It's called a false dilemma. A false dilemma is when someone wins an argument by presenting two sides and manages to convince the people he's arguing with that there are only two sides, but there is another alternative that he never brings up. And so that's why it's called a false dilemma. The devil is the master at false dilemma. And I want to suggest to you that in the battle of worship and the controversy surrounding how we should do worship in the Christian church at large and in Adventism, the devil has pulled a Morton's Fork on us. because he has created the perception that there are only two alternatives. One is what we perceive to be the traditional Adventist form of worship, which in a few moments I will show you is not really the traditional form of Adventist worship, but it's perceived to be that. And the other option is where we use worldly methods to try to generate excitement in the worship service. And this has been really a dilemma for people, because there are plenty of people that recognize spiritual dearth or spiritual death when they see it. It's not that hard to recognize. Richards, who I like to quote, HMS Richards Sr., said, "Some churches were so cold you could skate down the aisle." I don't know if that's true in Hawaii where it's so warm, but he was being facetious, but he was speaking the truth. Mrs. White had this to say: "There are moral icebergs in our churches. There are plenty of formalists who can make an imposing display but cannot shine as lights in the world." In Testimonies Volume 4, she said this: "The cold formalism that is now prevailing among us must give place to the living energy of experimental godliness." Much of the appeal of some forms of worship, which are not godly forms of worship, have been successful because people have been reacting against cold formalism. And oftentimes in the battle, when people are throwing big rocks and saying, "Well, we're the ones that are true to the traditional method," we fail to recognize that some of us who have been fixed in what we thought was the good old path have been largely responsible through cold formalism of driving people away to look for something else more exciting. And what I read is that the world supposedly will look to God's people and recognize something better. So does that happen? Should that happen on Sabbath morning? I believe so. I remember in my own journey on this quest to understand and try to delve into and work out this worship question in my mind, I took a trip to Willow Creek some years ago. You heard of Willow Creek? It's not really as so popular to talk about now. Saddleback has kind of obviated that and become more popular, but this was back in the years when Willow Creek was sort of the big talk. And I was a student at Andrews, and so a group of us went over to Willow Creek, actually one Sabbath afternoon, because they had Sabbath services late in the day. They had multiple services because they had, at that time, I think about 20,000 people attending there, and they could seat about 5,000 in the auditorium, so they had multiple services. And the police would actually have to show up to direct parking. It's a massive facility and quite an operation. And there were some features about Willow Creek that I found very interesting. They started on time and they ended on time. 1 hour. I'll do my best. They had professionals. They had a professional band that composed music for the service. They had professional actors that did skits and drama. But the most distinctive thing about the Willow Creek experience that I observed was that as a visitor, you didn't have to do anything. In fact, even when it came time for the offering, which is, some people complain that that's the only thing they are asked to do at church is to give money. When it came to the offering, the person making the offering appeal said, "If you're visiting today, I just want you to know this one's on us. Just let the plate go by, don't worry about it." And so as a visitor, in fact, there was no standing up or sitting down. There was no congregational singing that I recall when I was there. It was all performed. And now maybe things have changed, but at that time, my understanding, based on some reading I did, was that the way that they formulated their worship plan was they went door to door and asked people if they were Christian and if they attended church. And if they said yes, they attended church, then they would say great. You know, they would pass on to the next person. But if they found people that had been Christian and had stopped going to church, they would ask them, "Why did you quit going to church?" And they started to gather answers like this: "Well, I didn't know what to do. I was embarrassed because I didn't know if I was supposed to stand up or sit down. I felt uncomfortable." And so they devised their worship plan on this concept, at least in the beginning. And so largely it was a non-participative experience. So, you know, some years later, someone gave me a DVD of a special report by Peter Jennings, of course, since died, but at that time, ABC News evening news anchor. And the name of the program was In the Name of God. And some of you might have seen this program. He interviewed different people and went to churches that were the talk of the time, and he went to Willow Creek. And I remember particularly he interviewed a machinist who had started to attend Willow Creek and really liked it. And the part that stood out in my mind was late in the interview with this gentleman, he asked him, what is it about Willow Creek that you like? And the machinist said, going to Willow Creek, going to church there, is like going to the movies. I can just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. So I recognized it wasn't just my observation that this was a low-commitment program. I remember bumping into a colleague of mine. We had gone to school together. Another theology major had gone out in the pastoral world. And he told me something, his observation. He had been involved in trying to implement the Willow Creek ideas in Adventist setting. And he said to me, Dave, he said, we're finding that it's not working. And I was interested. I said, why? Why is it not working? He said, well, the problem is that when you're targeting people that don't want commitment, and you're targeting a low commitment model, and then you bring Adventism into the picture, which is high commitment, you reach a gap there. And you think about it, it's true about our message. Our message reaches into every part of your life, right? It gets into your refrigerator. It gets into your wallet. It gets into your thoughts. There is no part of your life that our message does not touch. It's high commitment. And he said there comes a point where we just have difficulty getting over that gap when we're essentially marketing to people on a low commitment basis and then trying to suddenly switch gears on them. I thought that was interesting. So, what is God's plan for worship? As I started to dig more deeply into the subject, I discovered that the devil had played a Morton's fork on me as I looked at these two options, that there was another option. And it's an option that has largely been lost sight of. But it is a form of worship that actually is traditional Adventism, because it's the way that Adventists used to worship decades and decades ago. But I would venture to say that probably not one of us here has seen and truly traditional Adventist service as we once had. So how are we going to come to understand it? Well, I want to start with some scriptures. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31, if you'll turn there, we have a principle. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31. You know this verse. Whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God. Worship starts with my personal life. And there is no way that we can have a vibrant, energetic time together if we don't have a vibrant, energetic worship experience alone. Because then, when we have that vibrant, energetic experience, we come together, it becomes the sum total of all of this vibrant energy together. And just common sense tells you that has to be better. So worship starts with my daily priorities. The way I live my life is worship. It was interesting to me, I was talking to someone here on the island the other day. They're a windsurfer, and he was saying that that is his house of worship out there on the waves. That is his house of worship. You know, I was thinking, do we see our life every day in the same frame of mind that that man sees it, that it's worship all the time, that God is calling me to a life full of worship, that everything I do should exhibit this. This involves my priorities. What are your priorities? It has a lot to do with your worship. Usually, when we ask people about priorities, well, sometimes we say, make a priority list, but that's the wrong thing to do. Because if I ask you to make a priority list, you will most likely write down the things that you know should be priorities. What's more useful is to say, write down the things that you did yesterday. Because those are your priorities, right? Whether or not we want to admit it, the things that we actually do are our priorities. It's uncomfortable because generally there is a discrepancy between what should be our priorities and what we do. But that would be more helpful at moving us in the right direction in terms of our personal worship experience. This whole idea of the personal individual worship experience and what happens in church is brought into even sharper focus if we look at Psalm 34. Just turn to Psalm 34 quickly if you would. And here's a picture of true worship. Psalm chapter 34, verse 3. Psalm 34, verse 3. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name. What's the last word? Together. Worship is not a performance. Now, I recognize, you know, there's nothing evil about a pew. But we do have to fight some tendencies, even in the general layout that we're sitting in this morning, because this is designed for you to be the spectator and for the person up here to be the performer. Maybe I shouldn't say it's designed that way, but it certainly can lend itself to go that way. And what also comes into the picture is that we have often, many of us, been brought up with a concept that to be reverent or to be appropriate in church means that we are to be quiet. And I'm not recommending that we all talk at the same time. But the interesting thing is that this is not the picture of worship in the early Christian church, where the worshipers all came and were quiet, and one or two people carried out the worship for everyone else. So if you go to 1 Corinthians 14, here you'll find a more accurate picture of the early Christian worship experience. In fact, it's brought out, I think, in an interesting way in the scriptures, because the Apostle Paul was having to deal with the problem that everyone was trying to be participative in worship at the same time. And so he was saying, you know, we got to have some order here. But what this reveals is that there was much, much more participation than what we generally see today in worship. So notice this in 1 Corinthians 14, starting at verse 26. How is it then, brethren, when ye come together, every one of you hath a psalm, hath a doctrine, hath a tongue, hath a revelation, hath an interpretation? What? How many did he say? Every one. Did you see that? And then look, let all things be done unto edifying. Now, is he saying, hey, everybody shouldn't come to church with something to do? No, that's not what he's saying, because we read on. If any man speak in an unknown tongue, let it be by two, or at the most by three, and that by course. That means one at a time, not everybody at the same time. Let one interpret. But if there be no interpreter, let him keep silence in the church. By the way, you know, this is a really simple rule. People get very uncomfortable and scared about a false gift of tongues, because we know there is such a thing. But I think the simplest way to deal with that is you got to have an interpreter. That's what the Bible says. Now, notice verse 29. Let the prophets speak two or three. The prophets. Well, we need to understand something. There is a true gift of prophecy that the Bible speaks of. But also keep in mind that the word prophet was also used in the Bible in a broader sense for the one who speaks for God. And I believe that's the sense it's being used here, is the one who's speaking for God, the one who's going to present a message or a study. Notice this. Let the prophet speak two or three. Okay, if you're going to have some sermons, try to limit it to two or three sermons in the worship service. How do you like that? Notice as we keep reading, if anything, this is verse 30, if anything be revealed to another that sitteth by, let the first hold his peace. For ye may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and all may be comforted. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all churches of the saints. Now I could keep reading on, and of course at the end of the chapter he says, let all things be done decently and in order, but I think you get the idea. Is Paul was dealing with a situation where everyone was doing what they were doing all at the same time. But let us not miss the point that as we take a look at worship, the picture of worship that gives me is that there was much more participation and much more involvement in the membership of the church in the worship service. Now, I mentioned in our last session that what I was going to talk about in this session was something that will help to move us into more ministry mindset. And I believe that what we do here on Sabbath morning can help to move us out of the pew and into a ministry mindset if we will move into a more participative worship service. By the way, is this really how early Adventism was? We see it in the early church, but it turns out that it was. Now, in the last session, if you weren't here, you can get a recording, and I read some statements by church leaders. One was an evangelist being interviewed by a newspaper journalist, where they said the way that the church was back then, distinctive from other churches, was that we didn't have settled ministers, that the church members largely carried the ball. But when it comes to worship, this is really interesting because J.N. Loughborough records a service that he attended, which is very unique. It was, as I recall, 53 minutes long, so less than an hour. And there was singing and prayer and, are you ready for this? 117 testimonies in 53 minutes. Now, there's a couple features about that that I like to think about. One is, if there were 117 testimonies, you're talking short testimonies. I mean, just do the math. And there's a couple things to be said for that, because we've all, from time to time, tried to listen to a long testimony when it was, sorry, but it was boring. I mean, we've all had that experience. In fact, just in case you think maybe I shouldn't say that, let me see if I can find this interesting statement about testimonies in particular. It's got to be a really good quote because I can't find it. Let's see. Wait a minute. I'm probably going to have to go look it up. She said this, that when someone goes on in a testimony for 20 minutes or more, it will kill the spirit of the meeting. That's the language she used. So, back to Loughborough's meeting. 53 minutes, 117 testimonies, plus some songs and some prayer. The other thing about a service like that is, you know, if somebody didn't say something that was helpful to you out of 117 testimonies, something is wrong. Because you get that many people sharing. And by the way, you can find, I should post this on our website. I haven't done that. I'll try and do this. Our website is backtoenoch.org. And so in resources and other documents and articles, I'll post this over the next week or so. I'll ask Laura to remind me to do that. There's a blow-by-blow account of a testimonial service that is on the CD-ROM. Someone was taking notes rapidly, and it's very, very interesting. But the kind of testimony service we're talking about is people would actually sometimes open up and share a testimony about a problem that they had in their life, right there to the whole church. And others would jump up and share a testimony about how God gave them victory over that very thing. Someone would stand up and say, I've been struggling with tobacco for years, and today I was convicted I need to give it up. I've been in the church, nobody knew this, and I need help. And people would stand up and say, hey, God gave me victory over tobacco, my friend, and he can give you victory as well. Sometimes there would be someone there who maybe a member or an elder was having Bible studies with. And you know the Holy Spirit would impress them, and right there they'd say, you know, Brother Jones, don't you think it's time you took your stand on the Sabbath? We've been studying it. We've been studying the Word of God. And I think it's time for you to take a stand. What do you say? They would Now, some of this might make us uncomfortable. But remember, without a little discomfort, we're not going to be growing. We're not going to be pushing the boundary. And that's why more interaction like this can be so powerful. I remember a Sabbath that we were endeavoring to move in this direction in a church where I was pastoring. And there was a couple sitting right over there. And They were not Seventh-day Adventists. They had come to some meetings and they were attending church. And one of the reasons that they were attending is because they were very intrigued by the different kind of worship services that we were doing. And this particular Sabbath, this fellow, he was a psychologist. So just to give you that background, it would help you maybe understand why he did what he did. But he raised his hand and he said, you know, I have a prayer request today. Last night, my wife and I had the worst fight of our marriage. And so he said this on the microphone, and I thought, well, you know, he's busted. His wife just had a poker face and obviously, you know, put her on the spot. So I realized we really have nothing to lose here at this point. It can't go down any farther for him. He's going to get it after church. So I just invited them to the front. And I said, would you please come to the front right now? And I appealed to the people. I said, look, how many of you have had the worst fight of your marriage ever? And you survived it, and God has been with you, and he got you through that. But you'd like to pray over this couple right now today that the devil's not going to win this victory in their marriage. And people literally almost jumped out of the pew to come forward and surround this couple. We just did it right then on the spot. I think this is an important thing, by the way, when we're talking about, when I'm trying to convey the idea, because, you know, you can do a number of things to help a service flow, and I'm not suggesting that things should be done in a disorderly manner. The problem is that when we come with a crystallized agenda of what has to happen today and nothing else, sometimes we schedule the Holy Spirit right out of the service. Sometimes. And we need to be willing. And this means that some of the greatest moments for ministry that can happen on Sabbath morning are often overlooked because they're uncomfortable moments, like the day that man said that. Typically, my response would have been, you know, he's in trouble, let's move on. Yes, next request, please. But what I was starting to see is when that happens, you must capitalize on it. When you have an opportunity to be relevant and to minister, talk about cultural relevance, to minister to a real need, you need to do it right then. And what happened was, numerous people came down to the front, surrounded this couple, and I just kind of dropped the microphone into this little sea of bodies that was surrounding this couple, and everyone prayed around the circle. And there were tears, and there was a lot of heartfelt emotion and caring concern for this couple. And I realized by the time the microphone went around that there was really nothing I could add, even though I was the minister in charge that day, I didn't need to add. And in fact, I felt that even if I were to take over now and pray, it would be as if their prayers weren't enough. And we started to have experiences like that. The interesting thing about worship service like this is that I had been exposed to some concepts of changing worship that are very different. And I had been told that generally the resistance to change in church comes from where? The young or the old? We always say resistance to change comes from the old. But I'm telling you the truth. I'm not exaggerating when I say that numerous elderly people in the church came to me, at least on two occasions, with observable emotion. Think of a lady with tears running down her face saying, thank you so much for the changes that you brought to the worship service. It surprised me. Now, it means that we have to be willing to get out of the box. And what about preaching? I know that for many of us, it's not considered church if we don't have a sermon. But I want to read a couple statements to you. In Testimonies Volume 7 on page 19, there are times when it is fitting for our ministers to give on the Sabbath in our churches short discourses. Now, I should read that again. Did you catch the tone of the language? There are times when it is fitting. There are times. Well, I thought it was every time. No, there are times when it is fitting for our ministers to give on the Sabbath in our churches short discourses full of the life and love of Christ. But the church members are not to expect a sermon every Sabbath. Here's another one from Letter 192, 1906. Our people should not be made to think that they need to listen to a sermon every Sabbath. Many who listen frequently to sermons, even though the truth be presented in clear lines, learn but little. Often it would be better or be more profitable if the Sabbath meetings were of the nature of a Bible class study. Bible truth should be presented in such a simple and interesting manner that all can easily understand and grasp the principles of salvation. So even though I like to preach, we decided to intentionally change the way we were going to do worship. And we started to schedule on Sabbath at the 11 o'clock hour what was in old days called the social meeting, which is prayer, singing, and testimonies. And on those days, we would mix it up, like I mentioned a few moments ago. We would have a few songs and have some testimonies and have some prayer and have a few more songs from our singers. We would, if we had four or five songs congregationally we're going to do, we'd spread that out through the service and do prayer and testimonies in between. And sometimes a testimony might be, you know, a praise of an answer to prayer. Sometimes it was a prayer request. And I discovered that as we continued to do this, there were two things actually that contributed to more people sharing. One was the more we did it, the more people got comfortable sharing. But the other thing was that we took our Wednesday night meeting and put it out into multiple homes and started small group meetings for our midweek meeting. And we didn't have prayer meeting at the church. And there was numbers, you don't have to do it that way, but that's what we did. And I discovered that there were people who were very shy, who were very quiet, but they started to share in their small group, and eventually they started to share more at church because that was kind of moving them into a level of getting used to kind of opening up and sharing in the service. Now, we didn't do that every Sabbath. We would schedule those. And I did have some rules, by the way. The rules were testimonies need to be 60 seconds or less. And they need to be preferably from today or yesterday, but okay, maybe over the last week. So we give a little bit of leeway. Now, I recognize there's times when more than 60 seconds is appropriate, but I would try to harness it tight. And the other thing is, we would tell the folks, you know, if you're going to go long, you know, be prepared to have an elder remove the microphone from you. So nobody's going to have their feelings hurt, but we need to give everybody an opportunity. And so it may be if you're running a little bit long, and it's hard to do that. Unfortunately, there was only one time that we had to do that, and it was uncomfortable for me. I had to do that. And I just started to gently pull the microphone away, thinking that would be the clue, but it didn't work. And she hung on, and I kept pulling it farther and farther away, until finally she let it go, and we were able to move on in the service. But the leaders need to be prepared to harness it in, because remember, we're warned, if a testimony is too long, it will do what? It will kill the spirit. So it's the responsibility of the elders and the deacons in charge to harness that in and to do it in a loving way, but God can help us to do that. Now, on the other Sabbaths, we endeavored to follow what I just read, this counsel that it would be of more benefit if, rather than so much preaching, that we had more of a Bible class study. And here's how we did that. Because we were working with the elders to do this also. And so I would work with the elder who was going to lead the study for that Sabbath. And our approach was, prepare a message as if you're going to preach it. Do your study, do your notes. And then after it's all together, ask God to help you identify interesting, compelling questions that pertain to the subject matter that you've studied and turn it all into a series of questions that will generate feedback. And we only had one rule for those kind of services, and that was, if you're going to say anything, you need to have a Bible verse to back it up. That's all. And you might not even know where the verse is found, but if you can, you know, somehow convince us that you got this from the Bible, you can quote it enough that we can recognize, yeah, that's in the Bible, that'll do. But most of the time, people would have the reference even. In fact, a friend of mine said, Dave, that's kind of a service will fall flat on its face because most of our people don't know their Bible well enough to actually no one will participate, and he was wrong. In fact, I found that I was taking notes oftentimes, writing down a text that someone would come up with that I'd never made that connection, and it got very exciting. Now, some people say, well, what's the difference between that and Sabbath school? Well, let me tell you a couple of the differences. First of all, you have a different person leading. Okay, and there is something to be said for that. Everybody is present, which they're not all present in the sanctuary for Sabbath school because we have our separate classes we go to. But there's something else that's also important to say. The Sabbath school generally is organized well in advance, far away from Pune. And there's nothing bad about that, but those lessons are all laid out. When you have an interactive study that is led by your elders, your deacons, you know, the leaders here in the church, you have the freedom now to get into subjects that are very pertinent to this congregation that may not have been identified by those who put together the Sabbath School Quarterly far away. There are some keys that I found to success which are important. One is don't be afraid of topics that involve variant views in the congregation. I hesitate to say controversy because I think that it's not necessarily wise to just be controversial to be controversial. But oftentimes it's very helpful for us to have a discussion on things upon which we have varying views. This brings into sharp focus that if this is going to work for us, and it needs to because it's God's plan for how we should worship, we need to have a commitment to unity. And there's a great misunderstanding, I think, among many people in Adventism that somehow we think we have to all agree on everything. And that is not true. That's why we have fundamental beliefs. Fundamental beliefs are those things, those are the non-negotiables. Those are the things that we need to be together on. Outside of that, there may be some things that we have some various views on. And if I don't have a teachable spirit, if I'm not willing to have an opportunity to see something a little bit differently, then I am missing out on one of the main purposes for us coming together for worship, which is to, as we read, exhort one another. And so, incidentally, one other point, don't ignore or neglect honest questions. And I would qualify it with honest questions. There are some people that simply want to be troublemakers by asking questions, and they're not really asking a question. But there are people that come with an honest question, and maybe that's not in the notes for the speaker. I remember a Sabbath in particular where I had worked with the elder, and when we started to do this, the elder and I would stand together in the pulpit, and he would lead, and I would jump in or participate and help him, but generally they didn't need any help, but they asked me to do this. They said, well, we're making this transition. We'd like you to work with us and stand with us in the pulpit while we do these interactive Bible studies. So that's what we were doing. And there was a lady that kept asking a question, but it wasn't the next point in the elder's notes. The notes were here on the pulpit, and I noticed that. But as I, you know, so he would ignore the question and try to carry on with his notes. Well, this lady, fortunately, was relentless. She wasn't satisfied with that, and she would keep asking the question. She wanted an answer. And finally, I noticed that in another part of his notes that the answer to that question was found, and I started to tap. I was trying to give him a subtle hint. Hey, just leave your notes for a minute and go over here. I wasn't saying that, but I was tapping louder and louder. And finally, he spotted it. And so we addressed that question. But there was another thing that happened that day that was really interesting. There was another lady who asked a question. She was a visitor. I had never seen her before. And so we answered the question, and I thought we did a pretty good job answering the question. Well, after the service, she came to me and she said, you know, when you guys answered the question, I was more confused than when I asked it. And you know, that's about the most heart-wrenching thing you could say to a preacher. She said, I was confused. It didn't help me out at all. And my heart sank, but I was thinking, well, you know, here she is. Now what do I do? She said, but there was a guy there named Alan, and when he said what he did, it clicked, and I understood. And so I looked at her, and I said, well, you need to go tell Alan that. Why are you telling me? You need to go tell Alan. So 5 minutes later, you know who was talking to me? Alan was talking to me, and his face was beaming, and he said, you know, this lady just came up to me and told me that it was my response that helped her figure out this question that you guys weren't able to accomplish. And as soon as I saw that beaming face, something crossed my mind. I thought, you know, there were two people there in church that day, for sure, that knew when they went home that they needed to be at church. The lady had a question, she needed it answered, and she got the answer. And Alan went home realizing that if he hadn't been at church, maybe she wouldn't have gotten the answer to that question. And that's when it started to click for me. That is why God has a different plan for worship. Because it means that all of us need to start being involved and participating. And when we leave on Sabbath, we know that God has called us to some kind of ministry, that God is using us in a way to touch other people, because it happens on Sabbath morning. God wants to do that for you. I want to return to Hebrews chapter 10, our scripture for the day, if you'll turn there, Hebrews chapter 10. And starting at verse 24. Hebrews 10, 24. Let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. You see, as we near the second coming of Christ, as we move into the most troubling times this world has ever seen, we're supposed to, more and more, assemble together, and oftentimes we use this verse to try to urge people to get back to church when they've dropped out. This is the verse that says, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. But why? Why are we to assemble together? To provoke one another. If we're not participating, we're not going to be provoking one another. God is calling you and me, every one of us here, to become active ministers of the gospel. We're living in the time of the priesthood of all believers. This is true worship. This is the kind of worship that is the third alternative that I haven't heard talked much about in the controversy over worship. It's another way. It's a better way. It's God's way. I want to encourage you as a church to move in this direction, to take the initiative. You know, you are in an exciting time right now. I know your pastor just laid a bombshell on you that he's not going to be assigned here anymore, but I believe that he would agree with me that this is an exciting opportunity for you as a church. You're now going to be shared with a big church, and that big church is going to not want you competing for the time of their pastor. And you need to recognize this as a wonderful opportunity, because churches need to do this. Who is going to model God's plan of worship? You stand in a remarkable opportunity to do that. Pune could be on the map in the nation for where something different is happening in worship on Sabbath morning. By the way, do you not think that there are people in this community that would be touched in a different way if they walked through this door and they weren't just hearing from a professional paid person up front, but they were hearing from someone like them who was talking about how their life was changed? People who could stand up in a service and say, yeah, I had this problem and God changed me and here's how he did it and I can help you too. You see, the reality is, if you will seize the moment, if you will embrace this opportunity and pursue this dream of God's kind of worship, that the odds are it will be the only game in town. That's what everybody hopes for. They want to be on the cutting edge. You have the opportunity to be the only game in town, maybe on the island, I don't know. And as word gets around, there's some powerful things that will happen. So I want to encourage you to recognize this great opportunity before you and to grab it and to run with it. And we have a closing hymn here. I invite you to stand as we sing it together. Number 358, Far and Near, the Fields Are Teeming.